fast at first, growing more steady as the miles flew by. The Mercedes hummed along, following the ribbon of road. The night enveloped us, the darkness broken only by the lights on the dash. All the comforts of a womb with the technology of a jet airplane cockpit. Ranger pushed a button on the CD player, and classical music filled the car. A symphony. Not Godsmack, but nice anyway. By my calculations, it was about a 5-hour trip. Ranger wasn't the sort to make small talk. Ranger kept his life and his thoughts to himself. So I reclined my seat and closed my eyes. "If you get tired and want me to drive, just let me know," I said. I relaxed back into the seat and wondered about Ranger. When we first met, he was all muscle and street swagger. He talked the talk and walked the walk of the Hispanic end of the ghetto, dressing in fatigues and SWAT black. Now suddenly he was dressed in cashmere, listening to classical music, sounding more like Harvard Law and less like Coolio. "You don't by any chance have a twin brother, do you?" I asked.
"No," he said softly. "There's only one of me."
Chapter 13. I woke up when the car stopped moving. It was no longer raining, but it was very dark. I looked at the digital clock on the dash. It was almost 3. Ranger was studying the large brick colonial on the opposite side of the street. "Louis D's house?" I asked. Ranger nodded. It was a large house on a small lot. The houses around it were similar. They were all relatively new houses. No mature trees or shrubs. In 20 years it would be a lovely neighborhood. Right now it seemed a little too new, too bare. There were no lights shining in Louis D's house. No cars parked at the curb. Cars were kept in garages or driveways in this neighborhood.
"Stay here," Ranger said. "I need to look around."
I watched him cross the street and disappear into the house shadows. I cracked the window and strained to hear sounds, but heard nothing. Ranger had been special forces in another life, and he's lost none of his skills. He moves like a large, lethal cat. I, on the other hand, move like a water buffalo, which I suppose was why I was waiting in the car. He emerged from the far side of the house and sauntered back to the Mercedes. He slid behind the wheel and turned the key in the ignition.
"It's locked up tight," he said. "The alarm is on, and most of the windows have heavy drapes drawn. Not much to see. If I knew more about the house and its routine, I'd go in and look around. I'm reluctant to do that, not knowing how many people are inside."
He pulled away from the curb and rolled down the street.
"We're 15 minutes away from a business district. The computer tells me there's a strip mall, some fast food places, and a motel. I had Tank get us rooms. You can have a couple hours to sleep and get freshened up. My suggestion is to knock on Mrs. D's door at 9 and finesse ourselves into the house."
"Works for me." Tank had gotten rooms in a classic 2-story chain motel. Not luxurious, but not awful either. Both rooms were on the 2nd floor. Ranger opened my door and hit the light, giving the room a quick scan. Everything looked in order. No madmen lurking in darkened corners.
"I'll come for you at 8:30, he said. "We can get breakfast and then say hello to the ladies."
"I'll be ready." He pulled me toward him, lowered his mouth to mine, and kissed me. The kiss was slow and deep. His hands were firm on my back. I grasped his shirt and leant into him, and I felt his body respond. A vision of myself in the wedding gown popped into my head. "Shit," I said.
"That's not the usual reaction I get when I kiss a woman," Ranger said.
"Okay, here's the truth. I'd really like to sleep with you, but I have this stupid wedding gown."
Ranger's lips swept along my jawline to my ear.
I could make you forget the gown.
You could, but that would create really terrible problems.
You have a moral dilemma.
Yes. He kissed me again, lightly this time. He stepped back, and a small, humorless smile pulled at the corners of his mouth.
I don't want to put any pressure on you and your moral dilemma, but you better hope you can bring Eddie to Chuchen all by yourself, because if I help you, I'll collect my fee.
And then he left. He closed the door behind him, and I could hear him walk partway down the hall and enter his own room. Yikes! I stretched out on the bed, fully clothed, lights on, eyes wide. When my heart stopped hammering in my chest and my nipples started to relax, I got up and splashed water on my face. I set the alarm for 8. Yippee, 4 hours to sleep. I turned the light out and crawled into bed. Couldn't sleep. Too many clothes. I got up and stripped down to my panties and crawled into bed. Nope, couldn't sleep that way either. Not enough clothes. I put my shirt back on, crawled back under the covers, and instantly clonked off to dreamland. When Ranger knocked on my door at 8:30, I was as ready as I was going to get. I'd taken a shower and done the best I could with my hair in the absence of gel. I carry a lot of stuff in my bag. Who would have thought I'd need gel? Ranger had coffee and fruit and a whole grain bagel for breakfast. I had an Egg McMuffin, a chocolate shake, and breakfast fries. Plus, Ranger was treating, so I got a Disney action figure. It was warmer in Richmond than it had been in Jersey. Some of the trees and early azaleas were flowering. The sky was clear and struggling to be blue. It was going to be a good day for bullying a couple old ladies. Traffic was heavy on the major roads, but disappeared the instant we entered Louis D's neighborhood. School buses had come and gone, and the adult inhabitants were off to yoga class, the gourmet market, the tennis club, gymboree, and work. The neighborhood had a lived-in, get-up-and-go feel this morning, with the exception of Louis D's house. Louis D's house looked exactly as it had at 3 a.m., dark and still. Ranger called Tank and was told Ronald left his house at 8 with the cooler. Tank had followed him south to Whitehorse and then turned back once he was certain Ronald was on his way to Richmond. "So, what do you think of the house?" I asked Ranger.
"I think it looks like it has a secret."
We both got out of the car and walked to the door. Ranger rang the bell. After a moment, the door was opened by a woman in her early 60s. Her brown hair was cut short and framed a long, narrow face dominated by thick black eyebrows. She was dressed in black. Black shirtwaist dress on her small, wiry frame. Black cardigan sweater, black loafers, and dark stockings. She wore no makeup or jewelry other than a simple silver cross around her neck. Her eyes were dark-rimmed and dull, as if she hadn't slept for a very long time.
"Yes," she said without animation, no smile on her thin, colorless lips.
"I'm looking for Estelle Colucci," I said.
"Estelle isn't here."
"Her husband said she would be visiting."
"Her husband was wrong."
Ranger moved forward, and the woman blocked his way.
"Are you Mrs. DeStefano?"
Ranger asked.
"I'm Christina Galone. Sophia DeStefano is my sister."
"We need to speak to Mrs. DeStefano,"
Ranger said.
"She's not seeing visitors."
Ranger pushed her back into the room.
"I think she is."
"No," Christina said, pulling at Ranger. "She's not well. You have to leave."
A second woman stepped out of the kitchen into the foyer. She was older than Christina, but the resemblance was there. She wore the same black dress and shoes and simple silver cross. She was the taller of the two, her short brown hair shot with gray. Her face was more animated than her sister's,
but her eyes were eerily empty, sucking light in and giving nothing out. My first impression was that she was medicated. My second guess would be that she was insane, and I was pretty sure I was looking at the crazy-eyed woman who shot Mooner.
"What's going on?" she asked.
"Mrs. DeStefano?" Ranger asked.
"Yes."
"We'd like to speak to you about the disappearance of two young men."
The sisters looked at each other, and the nape of my neck prickled. The living room was to my left. It was dark and forbidding, formerly furnished with polished mahogany tables and heavy brocade upholstery. The drapes were closed, allowing no sunlight to penetrate the interior. A small study opened to my right. The door was partially open, revealing a cluttered desk. Again, curtains were drawn in the study.
"What would you like to know?"
Sophia asked.
"Their names are Walter Dunphy and Douglas Cooper, and we'd like to know if you've seen them."
"I don't know either of them."
"Douglas Cooper is in violation of his bail bond," Ranger said. "We have reason to believe he's here in this house, and as apprehension agents for Vincent Plum, we're authorized to conduct a search."
"You'll do no such thing. You will leave immediately, or I'll call the police."
"If you'd feel more comfortable having the police present while we search, by all means, place the call."
Again, the exchange of silent communication between the sisters, Christina twisting her skirt in her fingers now.
"I don't appreciate this intrusion," Sophia said. "It's disrespectful."
Uh-oh, I thought, there goes my tongue, just like Sophia's poor dead neighbor. Ranger stepped to the side and opened the door to the coat closet. He had his gun in his hand at his side.
"Stop that," Sophia said. "You have no right to search this house. Do you know who I am? Do you realize I'm the widow of Louis DeStefano?"
Ranger opened another door. Powder room.
"I command you to stop or suffer the consequences," Sophia said.
Ranger opened the door to the study and flipped the light on, watching the women while investigating the house. I followed his lead and walked through the living room and dining room, turning the lights on. I walked through the kitchen. There was a locked door in a hallway just off the kitchen. Pantry or cellar, probably. I was reluctant to investigate. I didn't have a gun. And even if I'd had a gun, I wouldn't be much good at using it. Sophia suddenly came after me in the kitchen.
"Out of there!"
she shouted, grabbing me by the wrist, yanking me forward.
"You will get out of my kitchen!"
I jerked away from her, and in a motion I can only describe as reptilian, Sophia reached into a kitchen drawer and came out with a gun. She turned and aimed and shot Ranger, and then she turned on me. Without thinking, acting totally from blind fear, I lunged at her and took her down to the floor. The gun skidded away, and I scuttled after it. Ranger got to it before I did. He calmly picked it up and put it in his pocket. I was on my feet, not sure what to do. The sleeve of Ranger's cashmere jacket was soaked with blood. "Should I call for help?" I asked Ranger. He shrugged out of the jacket and looked at his arm.
"It's not bad," he said. "Get me a towel for now."
He reached behind him and brought out cuffs.
"Cuff them together."
"Don't touch me," Sophia said. "You touch me and I'll kill you. I'll scratch your eyes out."
I closed a bracelet on Christina's wrist and tugged her toward Sophia.
"Hold your hand out," I said to Sophia.
"Never,"
she said. And she spit at me.
Ranger moved closer.
"Hold your hand out, or I'll shoot your sister."
"Louis! Do you hear me, Louis?"
Sophia shouted, looking up, presumably beyond the ceiling.
"Do you see what's happening? Do you see the disgrace? Jesus God!"
she wailed.
"Jesus God!"
"Where are they?" Ranger asked. "Where are the two men?"
"They're mine," Sophia said. "I won't give them up, not until I get what I want. That moron, the Chooch, hiring his fence to drive the heart back to Richmond. Too lazy, too ashamed to bring the heart back himself. And you know what that little pisser brought me? An empty cooler. Thought he could get away with it, him and his friend.
Where are they?
Ranger asked again.
They're where they should be, in hell, and they're going to stay there until they tell me what they did with the heart. I want to know who has the heart.
Ronald DeChooch has the heart, I said. He's on his way here. Sophia's eyes narrowed.
Ronald DeChooch,
she spit on her floor.
That's what I think of Ronald DeChooch. I'll believe he's got Louis' heart when I see it.
Obviously, she hadn't been told the full story with my involvement.
You have to let my sister go, Christina begged. You can see she's not well.
Do you have cuffs on you? Ranger asked me.
I dug around in my bag and came up with cuffs.
Cuff them to the refrigerator, Ranger said, and then see if you can find a first aid kit.
We both had previous personal experience with gunshot wounds, so we had the drill down pretty good. I found some first aid supplies in the upstairs bathroom, got a sterile compress on Ranger's arm, and bound it with gauze and tape. Ranger tried the locked room off the kitchen.
Where's the key?
He asked.
Rot in hell,
Sophia said. Her snake eyes narrowed. Ranger put his foot to the door, and the door crashed open. There was a small landing and steps leading down to the cellar. It was inky black. Ranger flipped the light on and went down the stairs, gun drawn. It was an unfinished basement with the usual assortment of cartons and tools, and articles too good to throw away, but of no practical use. A couple pieces of outdoor furniture, partially covered with discarded sheets. One corner devoted to furnace and water heater. One corner devoted to laundry. And one corner had been walled off, floor to ceiling, with cinder blocks, forming a small enclosed room maybe 9 by 9. The door was metal and padlocked. I looked at Ranger. Bomb shelter? Root cellar? Cold storage?
Hell, Ranger said.
He motioned me back and fired off 2 rounds, destroying the lock. We pulled the door open and staggered back from the stench of fear and excretion. The small room was unlit, but eyes looked out at us from the far corner. Mooner and Dougie were huddled together. They were naked and filthy, their hair matted, their arms dotted with open sores. They were handcuffed to a metal table that was attached to the wall. Empty plastic water bottles and bread bags littered the floor.
Dude, Mooner said.
I felt my legs go and sank down to 1 knee. Ranger pulled me up with a hand under my armpit.
Not now, he said. Get the sheets off the furniture.
A couple more gunshots. Ranger was freeing them from the table. Mooner was in better shape than Dougie. Dougie had been in the room longer. He'd lost weight, and his arms were scarred with burn marks.
I thought I was gonna die here, Dougie said.
Ranger and I exchanged glances. If we hadn't intervened, they most likely would have. Sophia wouldn't have turned them loose after kidnapping and torturing them. We wrapped them in the sheets and got them upstairs. I went to the kitchen to call for police and couldn't believe what I was seeing. A pair of cuffs hung from the refrigerator. The refrigerator door was smeared with blood. The women were gone. Ranger stood behind me.
Probably gnawed her hand off, he said.
I dialed 911, and 10 minutes later a patrol car angled into the curb. It was followed by a second car, an EMS. We didn't leave Richmond until early evening. Mooner and Dougie were hydrated and dosed with antibiotics. Ranger's arm was sutured and dressed. We'd spent a lot of time with the police. Difficult to explain some of the story. We neglected to mention the pig heart and route from Trenton, and we hadn't muddied the waters with Grandma's kidnapping. Dougie's vet was found locked in Sophia's garage. It would be shipped back to Trenton later in the week. Ranger gave me the keys to the Mercedes when we left the hospital.
Don't attract attention, he said. Wouldn't want the police to look too closely at this car.
Dougie and Mooner, dressed in new sweats and sneakers, were bundled into the back seat, looking clean and relieved to be out of the cellar. The ride back was quiet. Dougie and Mooner instantly fell asleep. Ranger went into his zone. If I'd been more alert, I might have used the time to sort through my life. As it was, I had to concentrate on the road, working not to drift off to autopilot. I opened my apartment door, half expecting to find Benny and Ziggy. Instead, I found quiet, blissful quiet. I locked the door behind me and collapsed on the couch. I woke up 3 hours later and stumbled out to the kitchen. I dropped a cracker and a grape into Rex's cage and apologized. Not only was I a slut lusting after two men, I was a bad hamster mother. My answering machine was furiously blinking. Most of the messages were from my mother. Two were from Morelli. One was from Tina's bridal shop, telling me my gown was in. A message from Ranger telling me Tank had left my bike in my lot, advising me to be careful. Sophia and Christina were out there somewhere. The last message was from Vinny.
"Congratulations, you got your grandmother back, and now I hear you got Mooner and Dougie back. Do you know who's missing? Eddie DeChooch. Remember him? He's the guy I want you to get back. He's the guy who's going to bankrupt me if you don't drag his decrepit ass back to jail. He's old, for Christ's sake. He's blind. He can't hear. He can't take a piss without help. And you can't catch him. What's the problem here?"
Crap. Eddie DeChooch. I'd actually forgotten about him. He was staying in a house somewhere. It had a garage that opened to a basement. And from the number of rooms Grandma had described, it was a pretty big house. Nothing you'd find in the burg. Nothing you'd find in Ronald's neighborhood either. What else did I have? Zero. I had no idea how to find Eddie DeChooch. To tell the truth, I didn't even want to find Eddie DeChooch. It was 4 a.m., and I was exhausted. I turned the ringer off on my phone, shuffled into my bedroom, crawled under the covers, and didn't wake up until 2 in the afternoon. I had a movie in the VCR and a bowl of popcorn on my lap when my pager buzzed.
"Where are you?" Vinny asked. "I called your house and nobody answered."
"I have the ringer turned off on my phone. I need a day off."
"Your day off is over. I just picked a call up on the police scanner," Vinny said. "A freight train coming out of Philly rammed a white Cadillac on the Dita Street crossing. Only happened a few minutes ago. Sounds like the car is Squash City. I want you to get down there pronto. With any luck, there'll be something identifiable left from what used to be DeChooch."
I looked at the clock in the kitchen. It was almost 7. 24 hours ago, I was in Richmond getting ready to drive home. It was like a bad dream, hard to believe. I grabbed my bag and the bike keys and shoved what was left of a sandwich into my mouth. DeChooch wasn't my favorite person, but I didn't necessarily want him run over by a train. On the other hand, it would make my life better. I rolled my eyes as I barreled through the lobby. I was going straight to hell for thinking a thought like that. It took me 20 minutes to get to Dieter Street. Much of the area was blocked off by police cars and emergency vehicles. I parked 3 blocks away and walked the rest. Crime scene tape was going up as I approached. Not so much to preserve the scene as to keep the gawkers back. I scanned the crowd for a familiar face, searching out someone who could get me inside. I spotted Carl Costanza standing with several uniformed cops. They'd responded to the call and now were one step above the gawkers, looking at the wreck, shaking their heads. Chief Joe Juniac was with them. I pushed my way through to Carl and Juniac, trying not to look too closely at the smashed car, not wanting to see severed limbs lying about.
"Hey," Carl said when he saw me. "I've been expecting you. It's a white Cadillac. Used to be, anyway."
"Has it been identified?"
"No, the plates aren't visible."
"Anybody in the car?"
"Hard to tell. The car's only about 2 feet high. got flipped over and compacted. The fire department has their infrared out trying to detect body heat.
I gave an involuntary shiver. Ick.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I was the second on the scene. I took one look at the Cadillac and my nuts went north.
I couldn't see much of the car from where I was standing. That was fine by me now that I knew the extent of the destruction. It had been hit by a freight train, and the train didn't look like it had sustained any damage. From what I could see, it hadn't derailed. "Has anyone called Mary Maggie Mason?" I asked. "If this is the car Eddie DeChooch was driving, Mary Maggie is the owner."
"I doubt anyone's called her," Costanza said. "I don't think we're that organized yet."
Somewhere in my possession was Mary Maggie's address and phone number. I pawed through the loose change, gum wrappers, nail file, breath mints, and other assorted flotsam that collects in the bottom of my bag, and finally found what I was looking for. Mary Maggie answered on the second ring.
"It's Stephanie Plum," I told her. "Have you gotten your car back yet?"
"No."
"There's been a train crash involving a white Cadillac. I thought you might want to get down here and see if you can ID the car."
"Was anyone injured?"
"It's too early to tell. They're working on the wreckage now."
I gave her the location and told her I'd look for her.
"I hear you and Mary Maggie are buddies," Costanza said. "I hear you roll around in the mud together."
"Yeah," I said. "I'm thinking of making a career change."
"Better rethink that. I'm told the snake pit is closing down. The word is that it's been in the red for 2 years."
"That's impossible. It was packed."
"A place like that makes its money on the booze, and people aren't drinking enough. They come in and buy the cover, and that's it. They know if they drink too much, they're going to get tagged and maybe lose their license. That's why Pinwheel Soba got out. He opened an operation in South Beach where he has a walk-in crowd. Dave Vincent doesn't care. This was a lark for him. He makes his money on stuff you don't want to know about."
"So Eddie DeChooch isn't making any money on his investment?"
"Dunno. These guys skim off the top, but my guess is DeChooch isn't getting a lot."
Tom Bell was the primary on the Loretta Ricci case, and it looked like he pulled this one, too. He was one of several plainclothes cops milling around the car and the train engine. He turned and walked toward us.
"Anyone in the car?" I asked.
"Can't tell. There's so much heat from the train engine, we can't get a good read from the heat seeker. We're going to have to wait until the engine cools or we get the car off the track and opened up. And that's going to take a while. Part of it's caught under the engine. We're waiting for equipment to get here. What we know is there's no one alive in the car. And to answer your next question, we haven't been able to read the plate, so we don't know if it's the car DeChooch was driving."
Being Morelli's girlfriend has its rewards. I'm afforded special courtesies like sometimes getting my questions answered. The Dieter Street crossing has bells and a gate. We were standing about an eighth of a mile away because that's how far the car got pushed. The train was long and stretched beyond Dieter Street. I could see from where I stood that the gates were still down. I suppose it's possible that they malfunctioned and came down after the accident. My better guess is that the car was stopped on the tracks deliberately and was waiting for the train to hit. I caught a glimpse of Mary Maggie on the far side of the street and waved to her. She worked her way through the curious and joined me. She got her first distant look at the car, and her face went pale.
"Oh, my God,"
she said, eyes wide, the shock obvious on her face. I introduced Tom to Mary Maggie and explained her possible ownership.
"If we bring you closer, do you think you might be able to tell if it's your car?"
Tom asked.
"Is there anyone in it?"
"We don't know. We can't see anyone. It's possible that it's empty, but we just don't know."
"I'm going to be sick," Mary Maggie said.
Everyone mobilized. Water, ammonia capsules, paper bag. I don't know where it all came from. Cops can move fast when faced with a nauseous mud wrestler. After Mary Maggie stopped sweating and she got some color back to her face, Belle walked her closer to the car. Costanza and I followed a couple paces behind. I didn't especially want to see the carnage, but I didn't want to miss anything either. We all stopped about 10 feet from the wreck. The train engine was still, but Bell was right. The engine was radiating a lot of heat. The sheer mass of the engine intimidating, even at rest. Mary Maggie stared at what was left of the Cadillac and swayed in place.
"It's my car," she said. "I think." "How can you tell?" Bell asked.
"I can see some of the upholstery fabric. My uncle had the car seats reupholstered in blue. It wasn't the normal upholstery fabric."
"Anything else?"
Mary Maggie shook her head.
"I don't think so. There's not much left to see."
We all walked back and huddled again. Some trucks pulled up with heavy rescue equipment and started to work on the Cadillac. They had a Jaws of Life standing by, but they were using acetylene torches to cut the car away from the train. It was getting dark, and portable spots had been brought to light the scene, giving it an eerie movie lot feel. I felt a tug on my sleeve and turned to find Grandma Mazur standing on tiptoe trying to get a better view of the accident. Mabel Pritchett was with her.
"Have you ever seen such a thing?" Grandma said. "I heard on the radio that a train hit a white Cadillac, and I got Mabel to drive me over. Is it Chooch's car?"
"We don't know for sure, but we think it might be." I introduced Grandma to Mary Maggie.
"It's a real pleasure," Grandma said. "I'm a big admirer of wrestling."
She looked back at the Cadillac.
"Be a shame if DeChooch is in there. He's such a cutie."
Grandma leaned across to Mary Maggie.
"Did you know I was kidnapped? I had a bag over my head and everything."
"It must have been scary," Mary Maggie said.
"Well, in the beginning, I thought Chuchi was just trying something kinky. He has this problem with his penis, you know. It don't do nothing, just lays there like it was dead. But then it turned out I was kidnapped. Isn't that something? First off, we drove around some, and then I could hear us going into a garage that had an automatic door. And the garage was attached to one of those finished-off basements with a couple bedrooms and a television room. And the television room had chairs that were done in leopard print."
"I know that house," Mary Maggie said. "I went to a party there once. There's a little kitchen downstairs, too, right? And the downstairs bathroom has wallpaper that's tropical birds."
"That's right," Grandma said. "It was all jungle motif. Chooch said Elvis used to have a jungle room, too."
I couldn't believe I was hearing this. Mary Maggie knew De Chooch's secret hideout, and now I probably didn't need it. "Who owns the house?" I asked.
"Pinwheel Soba."
"I thought he moved to Florida."
"He did, but he kept the house. They have relatives here, so they spend part of the year in Florida and part of the year in Trenton."
There was the sound of tearing metal, and the Cadillac was separated from the train. We watched in silence for several tense minutes while the top was peeled back. Tom Bell stood close to the car. After a moment, he turned and looked at me and mouthed the word, "empty." "He's not in there," I said, and we all choked on tears of relief. I'm not sure why. Eddie DeChooch wasn't such a great person, but then maybe no one is bad enough to deserve getting made into a pizza by a train. I called Morelli when I got home.
"Did you hear about DeChooch?"
"Yeah, Tom Bell called."
"This was really strange. I think DeChooch just left the car there to get run over."
"Tom thought that, too."
"Why would DeChooch do that?"
"Because he's crazy."
I didn't think DeChooch was crazy. You want to see crazy? Take a look at Sophia. DeChooch had problems, physical and emotional, and his life was snowballing out of control. A few things went wrong, and he tried to fix them, and it just kept getting worse instead of better. I could see how everything was related now, with the exception of Loretta Ricci and the Cadillac on the train tracks. "One good thing happened tonight," I said. "Grandma showed up and started talking to Mary Maggie, telling her about the kidnapping. Grandma described the house DeChooch took her to, and Mary Maggie said it sounded like Pinwheel Soba's house."
"Soba lived in Ewing off Olden Avenue. We have a file on him."
"That makes sense. I've seen DeChooch in that area. I always assumed Ronald was the draw, but maybe he was going to Soba's house. Can you get me the address?"
"No."
"What do you mean, no?"
I don't want you going over there prowling around. DeChooch is unstable.
It's my job.
Don't get me started on your job.
You didn't think my job was so bad when we first got together.
That was different. It wasn't like you were going to be the mother of my children.
I don't know if I even want children.
Christ, Morelli said. Don't ever say that to my mother or my grandmother. They'll put a contract out on you.
You're really not going to give me the address?
No.
I'll get it some other way.
Fine, Morelli said. I want no part of this.
You're going to tell Tom Bell, aren't you?
Yes. Leave this to the police.
This is war, I said to Morelli.
Oh boy, he said. War. Again.
Chapter 14. I hung up on Morelli and got the address from Mary Maggie. Now I had a problem. I had no one to partner with me. It was Saturday night and Lula was out on a date. Ranger would respond, but I didn't want to impose on him so soon after the shooting. And besides, there was the price to pay. I got heart palpitations thinking about it. When I was close to him and the body chemistry was working, I wanted him bad. When there was distance between us, the possibility of sleeping with Ranger scared the hell out of me. If I waited until tomorrow, I'd be one step behind the police. There was one person left, but the thought of working a case with him made me break out in a cold sweat. That person was Vinny. When Vinny had started the agency, he'd done all his own apprehensions. As the business grew, he'd added staff and put himself behind the desk. He still does the occasional apprehension, but it isn't his favorite thing. Vinny is a good bail bondsman, but it's rumored that Vinny isn't the world's most ethical bounty hunter. I looked at the clock. I had to make a decision. I didn't want to procrastinate so long that I had to roust Vinny out of bed. I took a deep breath and dialed. I've got a lead on DeChooch, I told Vinny. I'd like to check it out, but I haven't got anyone to do backup for me.
Meet me at the office in a half hour.
I parked the bike in back next to Vinny's midnight blue Cadillac. Lights were on inside and the back door was open. Vinny was strapping a gun to his leg when I strolled in. He was in requisite bounty hunter black, complete with Kevlar vest. I, on the other hand, was dressed in jeans and olive drab t-shirt with a navy flannel shirt worn jacket style. My gun was home in the cookie jar. I hoped Vinny didn't ask about the gun. I hate the gun. He tossed a vest at me and I shrugged into it.
I swear, he said, looking at me, I don't know how you ever make a capture.
Luck, I told him. I handed him the address and followed him to the car. I'd never gone out with Vinny before, and it was a strange sensation. Our relationship has always been adversarial. We know too much about each other to ever be friends, and we know we would both be willing to use that knowledge in ruthless ways if pushed too far. Okay, the truth is, I'm not all that ruthless, but I can deliver a good threat. Maybe the same is true of Vinny. Soba's house was in a neighborhood that had probably originated in the 70s. Lots were large, and trees had matured. The houses were classic split foyer with two-car garages and fenced backyards to corral dogs and kids. Most houses had lights on, and I imagined adults were sleeping in front of televisions, and kids were in bedrooms doing homework or surfing the net. Vinny idled across from Soba's house.
You sure this is the place? Vinny asked.
Mary Maggie said you'd been to a party here, and it matched the description Grandma gave.
Oh, boy, Vinny said. I'm going to break into a house on the say-so of a mud wrestler. Not just any house, either. Pinwheel Soba's house.
He drove halfway around the block and parked. We got out and walked back to the house. We stood for a moment on the sidewalk, looking at the surrounding houses, listening for sounds that might indicate people outdoors. There are black shutters on the small downstairs windows, I said to Vinny. They're closed shut, just as Grandma described. Okay, Vinny said. We're going in, and here are the possibilities. We could have the wrong house, in which case we're in trouble for scaring the shit out of some innocent dumbass family. Or we could have the right house, and crazy DeChooch shoots at us. I'm glad you listed it out for me. I feel much better now.
Do you have a plan? Vinny wanted to know.
Yeah. How about if you go up and ring the doorbell and see if anyone's home? I'll wait here and do backup.
I've got a better idea. How about if you bend over and I'll show you my plan?
There aren't any lights on in this house, I said. I don't think anyone's in there.
They could be asleep.
They could be dead.
Now that would be a good thing, Vinny said. Dead people don't shoot at you.
I started across the grass. Let's see if there are any lights on in back.
Remind me not to take any more bonds out on old guys. You can't count on them. They don't think normal. They skip a couple pills and next thing they're stashing stiffs in this shed and kidnapping old ladies.
No lights on in the back either, I said. Now what? Are you any good at breaking and entering? Vinny took a couple pair of disposable rubber gloves from his pocket, and we both snapped them on.
I've had some experience with breaking and entering, he said.
He walked to the back door and tried the handle. Locked. He turned and looked at me and smiled.
Piece of cake!
You can pick the lock?
No, I can stick my hand through the hole where a pane of glass used to be.
I moved up close behind Vinny. Sure enough, one of the windows on the door had been removed.
Guess the chooch lost his key, Vinny said.
Yeah, like he ever had it. Pretty clever of him to think to use Soba's vacant house. Vinny turned the doorknob from the inside and opened the door.
Showtime, he whispered.
I had my flashlight in hand, and my heart was beating faster than normal. Not exactly racing yet, but definitely jogging. We did a quick search of the upstairs by penlight and decided the upstairs hadn't been inhabited by DeChooch. The kitchen was unused, the refrigerator turned off and propped open. The bedrooms, living room, and dining room were undisturbed, every pillow in place, crystal vases on tables waiting for flowers. Pinwheel Soba lived well. Between the outside shutters and heavy interior curtains, we were able to turn the lights on downstairs. It was exactly as Grandma and Maggie had described. Tarzan country. Leopard-spotted and zebra-striped upholstered furniture. And then, just to confuse things, wallpaper with birds found only in South and Central America. The refrigerator was shut off and empty, but still cool inside. Closets were empty. Drawers were empty. The sponge in the dish drain stored under the sink was still damp.
We just missed him, Vinny said. He's gone, and it looks to me like he's not coming back.
We shut the lights off, and we were about to leave when we heard the automatic garage door roll up. We were in the finished part of the basement. A short hallway and a foyer with stairs going up stood between us and the garage. The door leading to the garage was closed. A bar of light appeared under the closed door.
Oh, shit!
Vinny whispered. The door to the garage opened, and DeChooch stood outlined in the light. He moved into the foyer and flipped the lights on at the base of the stairs and stared directly at us. We were all frozen like deer in headlights. It lasted for several seconds before he flipped the lights off and ran up the stairs. I assumed he was going for the first floor front door, but he ran past it and into the kitchen, making pretty good time for an old guy. Vinny and I lunged up the stairs after him, knocking into each other in the dark. We reached the top of the stairs, and off to my right I saw the flash of gunfire, and blam, DeChooch took a pot shot at us. I shrieked and dropped to the ground and scuttled for cover.
Bond enforcement, Vinny yelled. Drop the gun, DeChooch, you dumb old fuck.
DeChooch answered with another shot. I heard something crash, and Vinny did more swearing, and then Vinny opened fire. I was behind the couch with my hands over my head. Vinny and DeChooch were doing blind man's buff target practice in the dark. Vinny carried a Glock holding 14 rounds. I don't know what DeChooch had, but between the two of them it sounded like machine gun fire. There was a pause, and then I heard Vinny's clip fall to the floor and a new clip get shoved into place. At least I thought it was Vinny. Hard to tell since I was still cowering behind the couch. The silence felt even more deafening than the gunfire. I poked my head out and squinted into the smoky blackness. "Hello?"
"I've lost the Chooch," Vinny whispered.
"Maybe you killed him."
"Wait a minute. What's that noise?"
It was the automatic garage door opening.
"Fuck!" Vinny yelled.
He ran for the stairs, slipped on the first step in the dark, and went head over ass to the landing. He scrambled to his feet, threw the front door open, and aimed. I could hear wheels squeal, and Vinny slammed the door shut.
"Damn piss shit fuck!"
Vinny said, stamping around the foyer, stomping upstairs.
"I don't believe he got away! He slipped past me when I was reloading! Fuck, fuck, fuck!"
The fucks being said with such vehemence, I was afraid he was going to pop a vein in his head. He flicked a light on, and we both looked around. Lamps were smashed. Walls and ceilings were cratered. Upholstery had been torn apart by bullet holes.
"Holy crap," Vinny said. "This looks like a war zone."
Sirens wailed in the distance. Police.
"I'm out of here," Vinny said.
"I don't know if it's a good idea to run from the police."
"I'm not running from the police," Vinny said, taking the stairs two at a time. "I'm running from Pinwheel Soba. I think it'd be a real good idea for us to keep this to ourselves."
"Good point." We streaked across the darkest part of the yard and cut through the property behind Soba's house. Porch lights were going on up and down the block. Dogs were barking, and Vinny and I were gasping for air, sprinting between bushes. When the car was just a front yard away, we emerged from the shadows and sedately walked the distance. All activity was halfway around the block, in front of Soba's house.
"This is why. You never park in front of the house you're gonna hit," Vinny said.
Something to remember. We got in the car. Vinny calmly turned the key in the ignition, and we drove off like two respectable, responsible citizens. We got to the corner, and Vinny looked down.
"Jesus," he said, "I've got a boner."
Sunlight was peeking from between my bedroom curtains, and I was thinking about getting up when someone knocked on my door. It took me a minute to find my clothes, and in the meantime, the knocking turned to yelling.
"Hey, Steph, are you there? It's Mooner and Dougie."
I opened the door to them, and they reminded me of Bob, all happy-faced and filled with goofy energy.
"We brought you donuts," Dougie said, handing me a big white bag, "and we have something to tell you."
"Yeah," Mooner said. "Wait until you hear this. This is so cool. Dougie and me were, like, talking, and we figured out what happened to the heart."
I put the donut bag on the kitchen counter, and we all helped ourselves.
"It was the dog," Mooner said. "Mrs. Belsky's dog, Spotty, ate Louis D's heart."
I froze with a donut halfway to my mouth.
"See, DeChooch made a deal with the Dougster to take the heart to Richmond," Mooner said. "But DeChooch didn't tell the Dougster anything except that the cooler had to be delivered to Mrs. D. So the Dougster put the cooler on the front seat of the Batmobile, figuring he'd take off first thing in the morning. Only problem was my roommate Huey and me got to wanting some Ben and Jerry's Cherry Garcia at about midnight and borrowed the Batmobile for our quest. Since the Batmobile only has two seats, I put the cooler on the back stoop."
Dougie was grinning.
"This is so excellent," he said.
"So anyway, Huey and me brought the car back super early the next morning because Huey had to be at work at Shopper's Warehouse. I dropped Huey off, and when I parked the car in Dougie's yard, the cooler was tipped over and Spotty was chewing on something. I didn't think much. I mean, Spotty's always in the garbage. So I put the cooler back in the car and went home to watch some morning television. Kitty Couric is, like, so cute.
And then I took the empty cooler to Richmond, Dougie said.
Spotty ate Louis D's heart, I said.
That's it, Mooner said.
He finished his donut and wiped his hands on his shirt.
Well, we've got to go. Things to do.
Thanks for the donuts.
Hey, no problemo.
I stood in the kitchen for 10 minutes, trying to come to terms with this new information, wondering if it meant something in the larger scheme of things. Is this what happens when you irreparably screw up your karma? A dog eats your heart? I couldn't reach any conclusions, so I decided to take a shower and see if that helped. I locked the door and shuffled off to the bathroom. I got as far as the living room when there was another knock, and before I could get to the door, it was opened with enough force to make the security chain ka-ching into place and then break loose from its moorings. This was followed by cussing, which I recognized as coming from Morelli. Good morning, I said, eyeing the chain, which was dangling uselessly.
Not by any stretch of the imagination is it a good morning,
Morelli said. His eyes were dark and narrowed, and his mouth set tight.
You didn't go over to Pinwheel Soba's house last night, did you?
No, I said, shaking my head. Not me.
Good. That's what I thought, because some idiot went in there and destroyed it, shot the shit out of it. In fact, it's suspected there were two people having the gunfight of the century in there. And I knew you wouldn't be that fucking stupid.
Got that right, I said.
Jesus Christ, Stephanie, he yelled. What were you thinking? What the hell was going on over there?
Wasn't me, remember?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Well, then what do you suppose someone else was doing in Soba's house?
I imagine they were looking for DeChooch, and then maybe they found DeChooch and an altercation arose.
And DeChooch escaped?
That would be my guess.
Good thing no prints were found other than DeChooch's, because otherwise whoever was fucking stupid enough to shoot up Soba's house would not only be in trouble with the police, but would answer to Soba.
I was starting to get annoyed that he was still yelling at me.
Good thing, I said with my PMS voice. Anything else?
Yes, there's something else. I ran into Dougie and Mooner in the parking lot. They told me you and Ranger rescued them.
So?
In Richmond.
So?
And Ranger got shot?
Flesh wound. Morelli pressed his lips tighter together.
Jesus.
I was worried the pig heart would be discovered and revenge would be taken out on Mooner and Dougie.
Very admirable, but it doesn't make me feel any better. Christ, I'm getting an ulcer. You got me drinking bottles of Maalox. I hate this. I hate going through the day wondering what harebrained scheme you're involved in, wondering who's shooting at you.
That's so hypocritical. You're a cop.
I never get shot at. The only time I have to worry about getting shot is when I'm with you.
So, what are you saying?
I'm saying you're going to have to choose between me or the job.
Well, guess what? I'm not spending the rest of my life with someone who gives me ultimatums.
Fine.
Fine! And he left, slamming the door behind him. I like to think I'm a pretty stable person, but this was too much. I cried until I was totally cried out, and then I ate 3 donuts and took a shower. I toweled off and still felt overwhelmed, so I decided to bleach my hair blonde. Change is good, right? I want it blonde, I told Mr. Arnold, the only hairdresser I could find open on a Sunday. Platinum blonde. I want to look like Marilyn.
Darling, Arnold said, with your hair you won't look like Marilyn. You'll look like Art Garfunkel.
Just do it.
Mr. Morgenstern was in the lobby when I got back.
Whoa, he said. You look like that singer. What's the name?
Garfunkel?
No, the one with breasts like ice cream cones.
Madonna.
Yep, that's the one.
I let myself into my apartment and went straight to the bathroom and looked at my hair in the mirror. I liked it. It was different.
classy in a slutty sort of way. I had a stack of mail on the kitchen counter that I'd been avoiding. I got a beer to celebrate my new hair, and I sorted through the mail. Bills, bills, bills. I thumbed through my checkbook. Not enough money. I needed to capture DeChooch. My guess was DeChooch had a money problem, too. No VIG coming in anymore. No money from the cigarette fiasco. Little to no money from the snake pit. And now he had no car and no place to live. Correction, he didn't have the Cadillac. He drove away in something. I didn't get a good look at it. There were 4 messages on my machine. I hadn't checked them because I was afraid they were from Joe. I suspect the truth is that neither of us is ready to get married. And instead of facing the real issue, we're finding ways to sabotage the relationship. We don't talk about important things like kids and jobs. We each take a stand and yell at each other. Maybe it's just not the right time for us to be married. I don't want to be a bounty hunter for the rest of my life, but I certainly don't want to be a housewife right now. And I really don't want to be married to someone who gives me ultimatums. And maybe Joe needs to examine what he wants from a wife. He was raised in a traditional Italian household with a stay-at-home mother and domineering father. If he wants a wife who will fit into that mold, I'm not for him. I might be a stay-at-home mother someday, but I'll always be trying to fly off the garage roof. That's just who I am. So let's see some guts, Blondie, I told myself. This is the new and improved Stephanie. Check out those messages. Be fearless.